From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Our old friend Quentin Tarantino, you may know him, his film Pulp Fiction celebrates its 20th anniversary this year.
Yeah, boy.
Oh, my God. Certainly Flavor Flav sitting across from me. And in 2007, he took ownership of the New Beverly Theater and once famously said, as long as I'm alive and as long as I'm rich, the New Beverly will show films in 35 millimeter. As of this month, October, he's taking over the programming of the New Beverly. First of all, it's always good to have you back here. Thanks so much for doing this.
That's good to be here, mate.
And tell me about doing this, because you've had a fairly active hand in the programming there anyway.
From time to time. Anything I wanted to do or any wild hair I got on, an idea, I could easily program it and screen it there. But my association with the New Beverly pretty much starts about 10 years ago. When I realized because the New Beverly has been around, Sherman Torgan ran it.
Since 78, basically.
Yeah, 78.
Randy Carson. Yeah.
And it was a staple. It was a staple of my teenage years and my early 20s. I think most Los Angelinos can remember, especially a lot of like the special art films or foreign film directors, a lot of times the first films we ever saw of them was at the New Beverly. So then all of a sudden I started hearing through the grapevine that it was looking like the theater might have to close down. So I started thinking about it, and I go, as a lover of film, a lover of small businesses, and a lover of Los Angeles as far as what we need, and a lover of film culture inside of Los Angeles, my quality of life would be less in this town if the New Beverly closed. So let me just do something about it. So I started supplementing Sherman $5,000 every month. Just to kind of just help him out, to help him pay people, help him get some things done, and just so he just wasn't working so under the gun.
Covering his costs.
Absolutely. And it just was, there's never any like pay it back or anything. I'm just investing in you. I just want to see the place stay alive. And he really could never believe that I was doing it, but he was just, really lovely dude. And at one point, he goes, Quentin, I can never pay this back. And that's okay, man. I can afford it. It's fine, And he was saying, well, I'll tell you what, when I eventually pack it in, I'd like my son to run it for a while. But then after that, I'd like you to have the theater. And then you could keep it going after I'm gone. And I go, oh, wow, I love that idea. Well, thank you very much. Then unfortunately, Sherman passed on rather suddenly. Then I ended up, through a situation, was able to buy the theater. Because they never really owned it. It was just a lease.
Which I didn't know until you told me that.
Yeah, most small businesses don't really own their businesses. It's just too much. But after a certain point, they over 10 years, 20 years, but they still never really owned the building. And so that was the situation. So I ended up getting the building and was the landlord. And Michael ran it for 7 years and he did a really good job and it was real fun. But I always knew that at some point, I wanted to take it over. I have a huge film print collection. I wanted to start, we're still getting prints from studios and then prints from other collectors, but I wanted to start in particularly, cultivating some from my own collection because, I've been collecting it for 20 years and it's almost like my own little museum of what I've decided to curate and what I decided not to curate. And I used to do this all the time in Austin at the Alamo Draft House, my little festivals and stuff. And so what made me say, okay, like I think now is the time, aside from just wanting to do it for a long, long time, was the whole death of 35 millimeter for the most part as far as this town is concerned. And
as far as the business is concerned.
As far as the business is concerned. And I'm just really, really against it. I mean, everybody is like everyone's fighting for shooting on film, and I go, yeah, I'm fighting for that too, and that's important to me too. In fact, if I can't shoot on film, I'll stop making movies. But as far as I'm concerned, if we're just acquiescing to digital projection, we've already let the barbarians. We've already ceded too much ground to the barbarians. The fight is lost if all we have is digital DCP presentations, because to me, that's just television in public. Any way you cut it, it's television in public.
This is true. My guest, who's looking at me as if I'm one of the barbarians at the gate he was talking about, is Quentin Tarantino. As of this month, he begins in earnest programming at the New Beverly Cinema here in Los Angeles over on Beverly Boulevard, just two blocks west of La Brea. What you got coming up? What's I know you have Morocco, which happens to be one of my favorite movies. And I told you when I showed it in my classes recently, the kids were bored by it, which talk about barbarians. Anyway.
Yeah, talk about barbarians. I mean, you know, Gary, forget about even Marlene Dietrich. Gary Cooper is maybe the most handsome man, aside from Elvis, all right, you know, in the history of movies, in that movie in particular.
He was in his prime in that. He kind of glowed like a hood ornament. Yeah. In fact, this is what the way von Sternberg shot him in there. Mm-hmm.
Actually, that movie actually even has one of the only non-spoofy meta moments, if you think about it, in film at that time period, when the way it ends with Dietrich walking in the desert sands, and then you hear the sound of the wind and the sands, and then it cuts to the Paramount logo with no fanfare, literally the sounds left over from the previous shot. I mean, that's a meta movie moment, all right, but done seriously.
And completely sort of consonant with having that snow-capped peak, you want to hear those sounds by that. So it really is a really cool moment. When is that showing? When's that going to project over?
That's going to be playing on the 12th and the 13th. And that's going to be, it's a Morocco and His Girl Friday. And brand new prints of both of them, straight out of the labs.
Wow. What else do you have coming? What else is on the schedule?
Yeah, well, our opening on Wednesday, the 1st and the 2nd, is going to be really sweet because it's going to be a Paul Mazursky tribute. And we're showing Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice. And by the way, Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice and Bloom and Love. And Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice is a brand new print struck from me from Columbia as a present for Django doing so well. And it actually is the best print of Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice that exists on the planet Earth. Not only that, not only did they break out the elements to do it right, they actually got Paul Mazursky to come down and color time it.
Wow.
And he was very excited about it and was happy with it. And there's also something kind of really sweet about us doing this because we played this double feature about 2 years ago at the New Beverly, and Paul Mazursky showed up. And I was there, and we had an impromptu question and answer session that ended up being crazy illuminating, just really, really lovely. And then after the screening was over, he had a ball. And then he was like, hey, Quentin, you know, I go down to Farmer's Market every morning and have breakfast with some buddies. If you want to come down, have breakfast with us, sure, come on down. So, yeah, hell yeah. You know, so I go on down and, you know, it's Paul Mazursky and a bunch of his buddies. One was Ronnie Schell. Another guy was Jack Riley from the Bob Newhart show, a couple other old duffers that I wasn't familiar with. And then all of a sudden, George Segal showed up.
No kidding.
And we all just kind of had coffee at a farmer's market. And I remember it was even funny because I come walking up and Paul sees me and goes, ah, hey, it's that kid Tarantino. Come on down. He's the guy who did Inglourious Basterds. He's a really good friend of the Jews. Have a seat, young man. Oh, by the way, that German, he was pretty good in that movie.
Well, that's one of the things that's happened a few times there anyway. I mean, I was there when you did that night when you showed a movie that we both happened to really like, Man Friday.
Oh, yeah.
And had Richard Roundtree come and talk about that.
I know. Wasn't that fantastic? And you moderated that question and answer session. It was awesome with you and Richard Roundtree up there.
That was a dream come true for me, getting a chance to talk to Roundtree about that movie.
About that movie in particular, yeah.
Absolutely. One of the things that's really been kind of fun about the theater since you've taken over, there's been that kind of excitement just because of the audience alone that come because they want to see the movies and they know because they're going to see them in 35, they're seeing the way they're meant to be seen, which is that thing of painting with light, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I just had a really, you know, uncomfortable experience in Cannes this last year because they had the 50th anniversary of Fistful of Dollars. You know, a case, and I think me and you could both make the case, that action cinema more or less changed the day Fistful of Dollars came out. It was never quite the same anymore, even in terms of, especially in terms of cutting to music, which had really never been the case. So that's a really fantastic idea, 50th anniversary. And because I was a noted Leone fan, they wanted me to introduce it. And they showed this 4K restoration. I have an IB Technicolor, beautiful Technoscope print of Fistful of Dollars. I could have brought that. Well, anyway, we have all the big speeches. We all talk. It's the closing night of the Cannes Film Festival, and I sit down. And this is a movie I've seen a million times. You know, did it look nice? Yeah, it looked nice, but yeah, my Laserdisc looks nice. My DVD looks nice, all right? We're not talking about nice. I was depressed the whole screening because I'm sitting in the Grand Palais,
The big house.
The big house. And I felt like I should be pointing a remote control at the screen and hitting play. I was like, where's the effing menu? And, you know, is that fine in my home? Yeah, absolutely it's fine in my home. I don't think about it. But in the Palais, I felt like there was some glass between me and the movie that wouldn't have been there if we showed the 35mm print. And it just all just kind of helped me kind of just double down.
Was that one of the inspiration moments for you about taking the new Beverly into your own hands and making you think, now's the time to do this?
It was kind of a combination of the speech that I gave in Cannes about how I felt the digital projection is the death of cinema as we know it, the birth of TV in public, and the combination of that and just having to, every time I look at the listings in something like the LA Weekly or whatever, I have to, that sounds great. Logan's Run. I'd like to see that again. Oh, it's a DCP. Well, hell, I got the video at home. I don't need to see that with strangers.
Let me ask this then. Here's what I've always thought, and I want you to respond to this. Technical issues aside, film projects, for the most part, 24 frames per second. I always thought there's a kind of hypnosis that takes place when that's happening because there's an image flickering before your eyes.
Oh,
so it's got to
exactly
do something to your
happens.
Brain chemistry that I don't care how pristine digital projection is, it just doesn't have the same effect on the mind,
the flicker effect. And they're even trying to add the flicker effect in digital, which is ridiculous. And no, the flicker effect is an important part of how your eyeball and your brain in connection to each other works to take in the images. There's also a couple other things. There's another, there's even a poetic way, I think, actually, of saying it that's lost in digital is digital video, whatever you want to call it, all right, it's a technology to watch the movie. You can't open up an old video cassette and hold it to the light and see the pictures. You need a decoding machine in order to watch this piece of technology. However, film, you can take a film strip and hold it up to the light and see the pictures. Now, why that is important is people talk about the whole concept of the magic of movies. Well, part of the magic of movies is you think you're looking at moving pictures and you are not looking at moving pictures. There's never moving pictures in movies. There are still frames that when shown at 24 frames a second through a shutter gate creates the illusion of movement. There is no moving going on. It's the illusion of movement. And that it gets at the really heart of what I think is what you mean when you say the magic of movies. You're watching an illusion. But now there's even a scientific point about that. And I'm not up on my stuff enough to call everything by its proper scientific name, but there's a special cortex in the brain that when it sees certain tangible images.
That flicker.
Yeah. It's just images in particular. It makes a mental snapshot of it. And you have that for the rest of your life. You may recall it, you may not, but it's there. And when you watch television, digital, any kind of these formats, that part of the brain doesn't get worked. That snapshot never actually happens. But it happens if you look at a photograph. If you're holding a photograph in your hand, that happens. That snapshot happens. And it happens when you watch film. It's a tangible thing, and that snapshot aspect happens. And that's why all of a sudden you can remember being 11 years old watching The Love Bug or something, and all of a sudden, like, you and the theater, everything, boom, comes back to you.
Wow. Hold on. We have to take a break. We're going to hit pause here. This is old school technology. We'll take a break. My guest is Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about the new Beverly Cinema. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Welcome back. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is Treatment. I'm sitting here with friend of the Jews, Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about his new stewardship of the New Beverly Theater. And again, we talked about that brain chemistry. I think that's part of the romance of movies, too.
Yeah, I do.
And I think that kind of that thing you're talking about, that physical thing that happens, that altering of brain chemistry mm-hmm. from having seeing that physical photograph as compared to the way that the brain takes in digital ones and zeros, mm-hmm. adds something too, I think, to the way that as you, what you're talking about, the way movies sit in your soul.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things is, I've been collecting prints for like a long, long, long time. And, you know, there's the funny part about Death Proof was just as all this technology is going out the window, all right, is like right when I'm doubling down on the romance of the effed up print in and of itself with its Frankenstein collection of reels. This reel's good. This reel's bad. This reel's a dirty dupe.
This reel's not even there.
Yeah, exactly. And this reel's missing. or the projection is, oh, that's the hot lap dancing. I'm taking that from my collection. And that was kind of the idea behind the whole thing. But, you know, one of the things, I mean, we've been talking about some of the things in the calendar, and I've been trumpeting the fact that, oh, Morocco's a brand new print. His Girl Friday's a brand new print. Bob and Carol Ted and Alice, a brand new print. They are, and they're gorgeous. And I have, like, some wonderful IB Technicolor prints, wonderful four-track mag sound prints that are showing. But it's not just all about, oh, the most beautiful print in the world or forget it. You know, we're getting them from other places and we're getting them from my collection. And some of the prints, you know, aren't the greatest. They're not horrible. I'm not going to show something completely splicey that is horrible to get through or is missing vast scenes from what I want to show. But I'm really about the whole culture of film prints. And they all tell a story. All those prints tell a story. I'm showing Junior Bonner coming up. My print of it isn't great, but I love that print of Junior Bonner. I've shown that all over the world. And that print is fantastic. It's a little washed out. It's a little beat up, but it has character. And Peckinpah would love that print. And I would rather, and I don't want to show a pristine version of it. That's my print of Junior Bonner. That's how I've seen it for the last 20 years. That's the way I want to see it for the next 20 years. I like it that way. You know, so it's a real mixed bag, but I think all these prints have quality and personality, whether they're pristine or not. I mean, if you just want pristine stuff, stay at home and watch your Blu-ray. Watch Sony HD channel. Have a ball. Leave me alone.
Not yet. We still got 15 minutes to go. We should, for some people hearing some of these terms, you should explain. Now, Technicolor IB is Technicolor imbibition, in which they dyed the stock. I mean, they dyed the colors right into the stock. And it's a technology that had disappeared because that Technicolor plant was sold to the Chinese in the 70s.
And it's completely gone. There's no getting it back. Roland Emmerich tried really hard, and he couldn't figure it out how to get it back. It's just gone from this earth. How that can happen, I don't know. Every time I ask questions and they try to explain it to me, my brain turns into guacamole and I can't understand it. But how a technology can be lost of this earth, I don't know. But that happened. But the thing about the IB Technicolor prints that are just magnificent is they never lose their color. Those dyes are there to stay. The print can be dirty as hell and the color is just eye-popping.
And we should say, too, for many people, they want to see a real example of this, and I hope you at some point show this. A really beautiful example is The Godfather,
which
is Technicolor IB. Mm-hmm. And again, one of the reasons I use it, because you can really get the gradation between black and dark, dark brown and dark, dark blue. Project it, you can see all that stuff in the way you couldn't in a normal color a film print.
No, absolutely. I think the only IB Technicolor print we have on the schedule this month is our George C. Scott director double feature where we're showing Rage and Savage is Loose. And Savage is Loose is IB Technicolor.
But people should go just so they can see what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
See that there is a difference. And they're just things. If you're,
well, the most colorful film I have in my print collection by far is my IB Technicolor print of Yellow Submarine.
When is that showing?
Apple's kind of hard about letting us show it, all right? Because they did that new version of Yellow Submarine with a digital sound.
Yeah.
And so they'll let you show the one with a digital sound, but they won't let you show the mono one. But the mono one's with the IB Technicolor. So we got to figure it out.
So I'm wondering, since you put this thing together, what's a typical night like? I mean, what's the programming scheme for the evenings as you're putting them together?
Well, a typical night starts off accumulated from my collection is usually some sort of a cool vintage concession bumper that starts it off, whether it's for Coca-Cola or Dr. Pepper or something really neat and fun. Then we go into a short, whether it's a cartoon. I have a bunch of Three Stooges shorts. Like, for instance, when we show the 20th anniversary of Pulp Fiction, we just got a print of Brideless Groom. The Three Threes Distort, which is the one that has Emil Sicka, you know, doing "Hold Hands, You Love Birds," which is in Pulp Fiction. So it'll start with either a short, either a cartoon or something like that. I have a Abbott Costello episode. I can even like take little musical sequences from other prints and show it off. And so it always starts with a short, and then usually about three trailers that either upcoming stuff we got, or it's all geared towards the retrospective we're doing that night. Like, for instance, on the Paul Mazursky night, it'll all be Paul Mazursky trailers.
So what else you got coming up? What else is on the schedule?
Yeah, well, some of the things we got coming up, you know, again, part of the fun of it is actually putting together, you know, going through my big print collection. Like I said, we get prints from other places. But going through my big print collection and then just, oh, hey, this will pair good with this and this will pair good with that. It's, you know, it's all about coming up with the double features that make sense. So we're having kind of this month in October, every Wednesday and Thursday, a mini Steve McQueen festival. So like on the 15th and the 16th, we're showing Le Mans, you know, with four-track magnetic sound, showing it with the James Garner racing documentary, The Racing Scene.
Now, until you tell me about this, I'd never even heard of this film before.
I'd never even heard of it either. I picked it up in a group of films, not knowing what I had. I thought it was just going to be a funny car documentary. Then I watch it, and it's gorgeous. And, you know, Le Mans is practically a documentary any old way. And Racing Scene is a documentary because after Grand Prix, James Garner backed a racer and backed a car. And it just takes him on the circuit with his racer. It has a crash scene in there that is the most spectacular crash I've ever seen on film of a real race car crash.
Wow.
It's really kind of amazing. But then, like, for instance, then the next week on that same time, on the 22nd, the 23rd, we got a McQueen Peckinpah double feature, The Getaway and Junior Bonner. Then on the 29th and the 30th, we're showing Papillon, which is actually Steve McQueen's personal print of Papillon with 20 extra minutes.
Wow.
It's 20 extra minutes to close up to Steve McQueen, nevertheless. And I'm showing it with, which I don't think has ever been screened in Los Angeles, ever. I'm showing it with Enemy of the People.
Which I told you I'd never seen before except on television. I assumed it maybe played here for a week in New York.
I don't think it ever played here at all for a week. It played on Z Channel. I remember that was like its big premiere was on Z Channel.
I'm
showing
a
16 print of it because that's the only one we could get. But it's the same directors of both films. And they're two of the McQueen's biggest passion projects. One last thing in October I wanted to bring up, because it's something I want to kind of do, and this is a good way for me to do it, is, you know, oftentimes New Beverly would have a big long movie and then they show something else, and it seems like it's a waste, you know, a big long movie, it's its own thing. But we're also committed to double features. So on certain big long movies that doesn't make a sense to show another film, like for instance, on the 24th and 25th of October, we're showing The Dirty Dozen. And what I'm doing is I'm doing a big trailer show before we show The Dirty Dozen. So it'll be a bunch of trailers of the different guys who are in The Dirty Dozen before we start the movie. So like a Lee Marvin trailer and a Charles Bronson trailer and a Jim Brown trailer and a John Cassavetes trailer and a Telly Savalas trailer.
And a Clint Walker trailer?
And a what?
A Clint Walker trailer?
You're not showing Grizzly. He's such an insignificant member of the Dirty Dozen. I would show a Stuart Cooper trailer before I would show a...
I'm just asking.
I would show a Ralph Meeker and a George. I don't want to show the generals, all right? I'm going to show the officer class in it, but I would show.
I'm just a trained journalist seeking fullness of detail.
No, Donald Sutherland will be.
You could get him and Telly Savalas in with the Kelly Sebel's
trailer. That's the thing, actually. I'm showing one of each, and anytime two members of the Dirty Dozen cast are together, I'm showing a trailer of that. So I can show Tick, Tick, Tick.
Yes.
George Kennedy and Jim Brown, and I can show Kelly's Heroes. But don't worry, MASH will be in there as well.
Oh, good, good, good. And remember you tell me you've got a big night with Eli Roth.
We got a big one for Halloween. Actually, what we're doing is, I just noticed when I went back over some of the other schedules that, you know, Eli has been a big supporter of the New Beverly and has had his Eli Roth festivals there. But we've never actually shown any, you know, given it over to Eli as far as like a night of his movies. So on the 31st, on Halloween, we're having an Eli Roth marathon. And so we're going to show, he'll be there. And it's an all-night marathon. We'll show Hostel, Hostel 2, and Midnight, Cabin Fever. We might have a really neat special surprise, but we don't know if that's going to work out yet. And then after that, a couple movies that Eli, a couple, you know, gory Italian horror films that Eli likes, Until Dawn. And he'll be there hosting the whole thing. And as a matter of fact, he was supposed to be shooting then, and he moved his shoot up so he could actually be here for the Halloween marathon.
Wow, that's really great. I mean, since I got you, I quickly want to ask you about something before we go back to the schedule. I happen to know that on November 1st, you're being honored by the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in the Art and Film Gala, and I want to congratulate you on
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. You were a big part of that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, no, listen, it was your time, man. I just and part of that, too, was really inspired by what was an incredible night, which for those of you who happen to be at the Ace Theater in early May, you happen to see something that you will never, ever see again because that version doesn't even exist anymore.
True that.
And it's a live read of The Hateful Eight. Mm-hmm. Talk about what made you want to do that.
Well, you've been pestering me. I do live reads there for a while.
Pestering me. Wow. I'm sorry. It's just dusty in here. I'm not tearing up at all.
Well, you've been doing the live reads with Jason Reitman. And you kept coming up with something where like, hey, is there something you want to do? Is there something you want to do?
And we talked about a lot of things.
Yeah, and I came up with a few different things, but...
At some point, I hope you do one of those things.
No, I'm actually kind of curious about doing some of them. I still like the idea of doing Robert Aldrich's Attack in the play form as a reading. I think that would be a really fun read. I'd like to actually just watch it to see what happens, frankly. But then what happened was, as people had heard, the first draft of my script, I only gave it to a few colleagues, and one of them leaked it out. And that was very disappointing and kind of heartbreaking, actually. I got over it, but I was more hurt than I was, like, enraged. But so after I started getting over it, and rather than cursing the darkness, I decided to light a candle. And let me see if I can take this and make it a positive. Okay, if that has gotten out there... Let me do a live read of that. Let's try that. It was a little nerve-wracking going out there. I'm like, I think I said when I walked out, why did I think this was a good idea as I'm looking at 1,600 people waiting to be entertained? But, you know, that was kind of a cool thing in a weird way because I was already committed to the second draft of the script by that time. And by reading the first draft, it allowed me to drop stuff. But in a different way than normal, because it was like there were certain jokes in there that I liked, and we did the reading, and I got my laughs, and now I didn't need to carry it over to the next version. I was satisfied. I'm a bit of a whore, all right. When I got my laughs, do I need more? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. No, I was satisfied. That's fine. Now let me move on, all right. As opposed to that was a good joke, and I never got my laugh, and so you hang on to those jokes until you get your laugh. In this case, I got my laugh on a bunch of them, and I was able to let them go.
We are out of time. You have to come back and talk more about the schedule, but I know you're about to go off and make a movie, so you won't be as available. But you'll still be actively doing the programming for the New Beverly even when you're away.
For the most part. I mean, the first 3 months, October, November, December, are definitely all put together by me. And, you know, then I'll be going off doing my movie for a few months. And then I'm going to have, we got some really talented people working there, so they want to have fun too. So they'll be coming up with things. But I'll give them also some screenings that I want to have happen during my absence.
Well, I can't thank you enough. Thanks for doing this, man. This is really short notice, and thanks for coming through.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for doing it, mate.
My guest is Quentin Tarantino. You know his friend of the Jews. He's got the New Beverly under his stewardship now. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Melissa Morton. This show is produced and edited by Jenny Radulet. I'm a friend of everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.